I think that is the nicest invitation to conversation that I have ever received. Thank you. That was lovely. I've really enjoyed a chance to dive into this text, and I'm thrilled to be here as part of this ongoing conversation you're having around the rule of Saint Benedict. And one of the reasons I found myself so interested in engaging with this is because Unitarian Universalism, the tradition that I grew up in, doesn't have a monastic tradition or a contemplative tradition of its own. And so thinking about what are the wisdom, what are the insights that come to us from contemplative traditions across different religions is always fascinating to me. So I'm appreciative of this chance to dive into this wisdom that dates back centuries and that still seems so alive today. So I wanted to start with a little story about my daughter, who's now 9. But when she was about 4 or 5 years old, I was talking about friends I had here in the interfaith world, and I mentioned Father Larry, who works at the mission. And I said, well, you know, Father Larry, and she'd met him maybe at the Fiesta Parade or something. And I said, well, he lives with the monks at the mission. If you ever wanted to go see him and see the mission, we could go do that. And she was fascinated by this idea of going to see the mission. Every time we drove past it, she would say, when can we go see your friend at the mission? I really want to go and see what's going on there. And I thought, this is interesting. What's the enthusiasm for going on? I mean, the mission's interesting, but for a 4 or 5 year old, I was surprised at the level of interest. And so we talked about it more, and she said, you know, Father Larry, who lives with the monkeys. And I realized that this whole time she'd had this image of these monkeys that lived hidden back somewhere in the mission. And she was very disappointed when she learned the truth that it was. And if you had a conversation with Father Larry, it might sometimes seem like, in any community, right? In any community, sometimes it can feel like maybe you're living with monkeys, not monks. And that's also one of the things I appreciated about reading this was how much human community is the same throughout the ages. And even the most sacred communities, even the most contemplative communities, still struggle with these questions about how do you live together? How do you exist? How many of you have ever thought about running off to join a monastery? Right? Really, how many of you have ever thought, gosh, wouldn't it be great to just wander the gardens, read whatever you felt like reading, and sitting in deep thought and engaging in meaningful and deep conversations? I mean, what if that was your life, right? I've had those thoughts. I think in this modern age when things can move so quickly and there are so many different streams of information coming at us all the time, it can seem so appealing to kind of shed all of that and enter into some sort of contemplative life. I think the things, however, that are talked about in this book reveal that it's not always so easy, right? Monks are still people. Conflict still arises. People struggle with authority. Who has it? How do they exercise it? There's a fear of death and dying that people are grappling with. It's a very human text, the Rule of Saint Benedict. But one of the things that I do think is special about the monastic life that was revealed in these chapters, and in the 2 chapters we'll be talking about in just a moment, is one of the particularities, it seems to me, of the contemplative life is this concept of paying attention, right? That this is a life dedicated to attending to the divine in the world, the divine inside ourselves, and lifting up through that attention things that often are hidden when we're going about our daily lives in the rush and the muddle of everything. So I thought I'd start out by asking a question about attention. This morning, can you remember this morning? Right? Just cast your mind back to maybe an hour ago or whatever it was. If you can cast your mind back, go on a little exercise with me, to the first moment you opened your eyes this morning. When you first woke up, what did you see? Were you aware of what you saw in that moment? As much detail as you can get in that first moment of awakening this morning. And try to sort out, is it what you really saw, or was it what you remember you think you saw because that's what your room looks like? Right? Try to get underneath all of those layers of memory to just this morning. The quality of the light in the room, the temperature, any other creatures or beings that were in that room with you. And then as you moved through your morning, was there anything that you would say grabbed your attention? Anyone want to share anything that grabbed your attention this morning? Any thoughts? What grabbed your attention this morning? Do you want to come up to the mic? I'll repeat what you say. Your eyes hurt. So their eyes hurt. It was darker than you expected. It can't be time to get up. And then the warmth, the heat of your cat curled up next to you, right? These overlaying sensory bits, the seasons changing, right, were part of this morning for you. What else? What else grabbed your attention this morning?
Halfway through my first cup of coffee, our daughter called and said she had locked herself out of her apartment and her dog was inside.
Well, the first thing when I wake up every morning, especially if I'm facing to my right, is I don't ever close my curtains. Fortunately, there's a meadow behind us and nobody's there, so I always leave all my drapes open, and I wake up and I just see all this greenery and the sun coming in, and like you're saying, the change of seasons and the cat, and there's just something bright and cheerful, and I just can't wait to get out of bed and get going and get here on time and all that kind of stuff. But I don't know, I wake up with the mountain views, and it's just a cheerful way of starting my day.
After I woke up this morning, I looked out, and there was a blue jay with an acorn in his mouth. Now, about 20 years ago, I climbed up to the top of Cathedral Peak by myself, and I had to hitchhike down alone. But the vision I had when I was up there was that a blue jay was on my chest putting an acorn in my mouth. Now, that was 20 years ago, and I went through a horrible transition from my marriage. But at 50, that what I found out that the blue jay putting an acorn in my mouth was like how a great oak tree starts out. And a few months later, I went into law school and got my law degree at 50. And I was sharing this story with my son this week, and I said, "You're the baby acorn or whatever." And I got to see him become a man this week and go to apologize to his father and say, "I'm sorry that I have been disrespectful since I was in high school," and he's 40 now. So in sharing that story with him and the acorn in the blue jay, and then we both were able this morning to see that blue jay with the acorn.
Wow. Isn't it amazing how when you pay attention to something, all of a sudden this interconnectedness emerges from a simple sight that just spans across time and space. It's incredible when you start to pay attention.
Well, when I woke up this morning, I was conscious of a thought that I haven't had before. I've recently moved, and this was the first time that I woke up and I didn't think, "Where am I?"
Did anything else grab your attention this morning?
So I woke up like at 4:30, and there's a lot of birds. You know, since we've had the fire and everything, I think a lot of birds have moved to my neighborhood. There's more birds than there used to be. And I could hear bird calls, and I don't usually think about it. I hear crows. But there were, I was going, I wonder what that bird is and that bird. And today's my husband's birthday. And part of waking up was just saying that I'm going to really pay attention to him. That's what he didn't want a gift, you know. But just waking up and saying, there's some things that we talk about sometimes where we remind each other why we're with each other. And that's what happened this morning. So we were like really actually very conscious of waking up and what was going on.
There's a kind of humility in paying attention, because when you pay attention, you also recognize what you don't know. The birds and their mysterious calls, right? There's a certain amount of letting go of yourself and paying attention to others. So I think as looking at the titles of these chapters, these are kind of ways of calling attention to particular things. Sometimes things that are feel warm and fuzzy, and sometimes things that are hard and difficult and that we normally try to put aside, right? I don't want to pay attention to death. I don't want to pay attention to my own faults in one of the chapters that we're going to be talking about. I don't want to pay attention to conflict. That's uncomfortable. But in the monastic and contemplative tradition, there's this expansive room to hold attention on all of these things that I find so appealing. And I think one of my own inclinations to want to understand what a contemplative life is about is an envy of that spaciousness to really attend to this multiplicity of things about being human that often just get shunted aside, either because we're busy or emotionally overwhelmed or living in chaotic times and it feels like we just want to shut down. When we allow ourselves that expansiveness of attention, I think some really beautiful insights arise. So let's dive into that a little bit. But I want to switch tracks before we get into the chapters and talk a little bit about where I'm coming from as a Unitarian Universalist. I know it's a mouthful. It's one of the things Michael and I were talking about. This long name, Unitarian Universalist. Is it the Unity Church? It's hard to say all at once. And I wonder how many of you are familiar at all with Unitarian Universalism as a tradition? A couple of folks, right? So there's quite a few of you. So I just want to give a little brief overview so you understand where I'm coming from and the tradition that raised me, right? Because each of us are coming out of these roots that shape our perspective, that shape our lives. And in places like this, one of the beautiful things that happens is our insights come from these roots and then become larger than any one of us could hold alone. So when I was looking at your roster of speakers, that beautiful collaboration, when we all bring our stories into the space, is one of the things that excited me about being here. So current Unitarian Universalism, there are seven principles that kind of define and outline who we are. And they are the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and society at large, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, and respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. Those are sort of the pillars of our tradition. But the long name Unitarian Universalism has roots that go back hundreds and hundreds of years. It originally started as two traditions. There were the Unitarians. And the name Unitarian arose as a juxtaposition against Trinitarianism, right? So it was an assertion of the unity of God rather than the Trinity of God. And so there are all these theological arguments back during the very origins of the Christian tradition, right? Back in the, you know, before even the Council of Nicaea, right? When people were arguing, what is the nature of Jesus? What is the nature of God? What is this text that we've been given to wrestle with? And then there were some people who were arguing for the Unitarian perspective, and some people were arguing for the Trinitarian perspective, and the Trinitarians won that debate back in the day. But Unitarianism has kind of bubbled along underneath until the Protestant Reformation came about, and it surged up again when people were reading and encountering biblical text in translation for the first time, and coming to some different conclusions maybe than they'd been given by the ecclesiastical authorities, questioning again the nature of things like, what does baptism mean? When do you baptize somebody? What's the nature of Jesus? And Unitarianism emerged again during the Protestant Reformation. And that's really where the Unitarianism of this tradition traces its roots back to. Although over time, it's kind of grown and evolved into this sense of not just this idea of the unity of God, but sort of the unity of experience. We all live in the same world. We don't live in a bifurcated existence. We share this one world, this one humanity, and we've got to figure it out together. So that's the Unitarian side of things. The Universalists got their name from the idea of universal salvation, right? So the Universalists were arguing that the fundamental nature of God is love. And if a loving God existed in the world, then everybody would eventually be reconciled with that loving God. So the Universalists came along and they got rid of the idea of hell, and they focused on this idea of love. And eventually, the Unitarians and the Universalists kind of theologically kept moving closer and closer together until in 1971, they merged and gave us this really long mouthful of a name called Unitarian Universalism. But the gist of it is basically that we all come from the same unity of experience, and wherever we're going there together, right? So we have to figure it out together in this life. We can't wait for it all to be sorted out after we die. We have an obligation to figure out how do we live together as human beings. These, of course, are not principles unique to Unitarian Universalism. They're principles that are shared and wisdom that is shared across a lot of traditions. So I think that the principles that I read earlier that emerged out of that are principles you can find in a lot of places. That was one of the things, for example, the transcendentalist Ralph Waldo Emerson, and right around the turn of the 19th century, people started reading other texts outside of just the biblical text. They started reading the Vedas, the Hindu texts, and the Upanishads, and said, hey, there's wisdom to be found all over the place if only we look for it. So that's a little piece of where I'm coming from as we dive into this conversation about this particular text and the wisdom found in the rule of Saint Benedict. So let's turn our attention to these two chapters, right? And the first one, the seeking the true self, facing our faults. Facing our faults, seeking the true self. This, I think, revealed another sort of gap in Unitarian Universalism for me, in my own tradition, in the faith that raised me. And I was raised a Unitarian Universalist, which is unique in my tradition. There's about 10% of us who grew up Unitarian Universalists, and about 90% of us came in from some other background. But when I was 6 years old and we moved to New Orleans, my parents started attending the Unitarian Universalist congregation in New Orleans to meet folks and get acquainted in a new town. And so that's the congregation that raised me. I've never been anything but a Unitarian Universalist. And as this tradition is maturing, one of the things we've realized is that there's no confessional practice in Unitarian Universalism, right? So there's no confessional booth, there's no common shared confessional prayer. We wrestle, right? So Unitarian Universalists, having gotten rid of the idea of hell and eternal damnation, right, really struggling with what is this question of sin and this idea of the inherent goodness of humanity versus the inherent sinfulness of humanity, right? That was another argument that the Unitarians were making during the Reformation, was against this concept of original sin. And so there was a very optimistic tradition, right? And so got rid of a lot of kind of the shame and the guilt, but maybe kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater. With that, because what we ended up lacking was a place to put those areas where we are in need of repair, right? A place to put that feeling of, I've done something wrong, and now what? This is a fundamental human need, to learn how to reconcile, to learn how to see where things have gone off the mark and get back on track, right? So that's one of the original meanings of the word sin, right, is meaning to have missed the mark. So if you think of it like shooting an arrow and you're off target, that is a concept of a way of defining sin that works better for me than most, right? You're trying and you miss. And so you've got to go get your arrow and come back and try again and practice until you get better and you end up aiming true. And so you have to have some way of addressing this idea of fault, of the places in your life where you feel like perhaps you've missed the mark. And so I want you to think for just a moment about what is your practice, either in your religious tradition, your religious home, or your personal practice, when you notice that you've missed the mark somewhere. How do you, first of all, how do you know? Is it a gut feeling? Does it live in your body somewhere? Maybe there's that sense. I have it in my, in like right in the pit of my stomach when I know. You get off the phone and you hang it up and you just know, like, oh, there's going to be some repair after that conversation waiting for me down the road. Or, you know, or it can be as simple as having missed a deadline at my daughter's school. And I get that same feeling, oh, I'm going to have to go to the teacher with my hat in my hand and say, please, I know we missed the deadline for the field trip forms, but will you take it? You know, it can be small or it can be big. But it lives somewhere right under my solar plexus for me. Where in your body does that intuition live? And then what do you do when you notice that? What is your practice for acknowledging fault? Where do you put it? Do you have a spiritual practice that helps you address it? I'm going to open that up for some sharing. Do you have a practice that helps you address that question of fault? What do you do?
On this journey, I'm right with you. I didn't know that. I'm so glad you defined that. I didn't know what you were. We're all the same, basically. So for me, it's in the self-talk. And the minute I make myself wrong, then I compound the error. So I go right to, okay, sweetheart, what can we learn? How can we grow? How can we do it differently? So we get a different result. So it's all in that loving, forgiving self-talk that I've been practicing for many years.
It takes practice, right? It's a muscle you have to build up. That's why they call it spiritual practice and not spiritual accomplishment, right?
Okay, well, I feel it right here, just a little bit higher. And it's really a constriction. And as I mentioned last year when I spoke to the group, I talked about the welcoming prayer. And I find that just noticing that constriction, that, oh, right there, you just sit with it and you hold it and you breathe with it. And it's part of our centering prayer practice. But once you feel that loosening, that letting go, softening, then you let it go. So it's a really a kenotic letting go process.
Okay. Going from the sort of the clenched fist to the open hand.
I was raised Unitarian. And then I married a Catholic. And so I took lessons in Chinatown at the old St. Mary's in San Francisco. So, of course, I wasn't used to any confession, you know. I would say, I see the Godfather, you kill people, and then you go to confession.
Right.
You know? Yeah. And so the priest was great. He said, okay, sometimes in your life you have things that bother your conscience. And he said, if you can't work it out between yourself and God, go get help. Go to a priest and ask for some help. So I got that. It's like, oh, okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, we're not in this alone. I think that's something that in this chapter, when they talk about finding somebody with some spiritual maturity to bring this to, right? Don't just worry over it in any old place. Find a grounded place to bring your struggles with your faults. Yeah, and if you only get your image of confessionals from the movies. One of the things I appreciate about this chapter, did you want to share something? Oh, go ahead.
I sort of have a little place inside where I take it. What a spirit lives in me. I think it's God, of course. And I simply, I can remember the last time I felt this pang of guilt. And I said, oh God, I'm so sorry. I did it again. And the voice came back inside me and said, did what again? So I think that's part of being able to forgive yourself. I mean, I knew what it was. And to have God's forgiveness was really all I needed.
I've been Catholic all my life, so born a Catholic, and close to religious people. But it wasn't until I came to Santa Barbara and I learned from the priest, Ed and Pete, focusing, and Jenlyn's focusing. And Jenlyn, who was not very much, so much interested in sin, but more in congruence, used to ask Ed and Pete, what are you doing with my stuff? Because they had dedicated their whole life to this process of allowing one to become conscious of the felt sense around anything. And I experience sin and an incongruent felt sense as congruent.
Yeah.
As, you know, one. And when the shift comes, there is in the body all's well, even if it's going to be difficult. Mm-hmm.
This never had occurred to me, but, you know, I think that many of us, when we feel we've done something wrong, or is we talk to someone, we talk to a friend. And I never really thought about that as confession, but in a way, maybe it is our way of trying to confess, but also I think the verbalization and the ownership. Because I think a lot of times maybe we do things and we're ashamed, or we don't want to say it, as you were talking and other people were offering, I'm thinking, well, maybe that is, you know, the two or more kind of aspect that I hadn't noticed, because if I've you know, been short with my daughter or whatever, I'm a human being, talking to someone just sort of lets me say, yes, I did that. I'm not trying to run from the whatever it was. I'm taking ownership of it and trying to usually talk through an amends or whatever. And we also, I'm thinking, when your friend tells you something, frequently I respond like in a way that's sort of, it's okay. So I never really thought of that as perhaps some human-to-human release and ownership, and it just moves the energy of this thing that we might be carrying and fretting over ourselves in a different kind of way. I hadn't thought about it as a practice because it's just a human connection thing, but maybe God designed us with that human connection thing, knowing the priest or the other one might be harder to find. So thank you for bringing that awareness. All of everyone's comments. Thank you.
We are designed for connection. I mean, that's the fundamental, however you agree at the origins of what we are as human beings, there is something fundamentally connective about us as a survival mechanism for community. We have to be connected.
Sometimes you can get rid of that bad feeling that you've done something wrong rather quickly. It just happened a couple days ago, yesterday. I was asked to do something by a daughter, and I did it, but I was a little grumpy about it. And I called her last night, and I said, I'm sorry I was grumpy. And she said, I was just about to call you and say, I'm sorry I wasn't grateful enough. And, you know, so, you know, sometimes you can do it real quick, directly.
Yeah. Direct communication is a wonder when it comes to things like dealing with fault.
Speaking about those of us who were raised in the Catholic tradition, which is it covers me too, I would like to point out that one of our little gifts that we're told to memorize is something called the act of contrition. I don't know if any of you have... Do you remember that when you were younger? Of course. I'm hearing, of course. Or, and, you know, yeah, it begins... Oh, my God, I am heartily sorry for having offended thee. And it goes on and on and on in this kind of Elizabethan English. And then at the end it says, I firmly resolve with the help of thy grace to sin no more and to avoid the near occasions of sin. Amen. And then the priest says, go in peace, say three Hail Marys, and don't do it anymore or yeah. Whatever. And... Now, the funny thing about this prayer is that the ending, I find, is curious because it says, it's a future-oriented thing. It says, with the help of, I firmly resolve to sin no more in the future. This is I think there are a number of us in the spectrum of humanity who are more contemplative in this regard. And there's others who are more practical. And for me, I've always had this practical streak where I say to myself, yeah, I've messed up this particular relationship, but I'm going to go on and do better and go forward. And it's not going to be what I say, it's going to be what I do that proves my change of heart.
Yeah.
I wanted to share that, that's all.
Having these practices, you know, the tools you're given as a kid, for better or for worse, stick with you, right? I mean, that's what therapy is all about, right? But it's worth revisiting, what were you given as a child around this question of fault? Is it useful or is it not? You know, a lot of times I think we get hung up on that definition of sin rather than the concept of confession and restitution. And we spend so much time arguing over, was it a sin or wasn't it? Because we were given things that we were told were bad, that as adults we grow up and say, wait a minute, that actually isn't really bad. That wasn't a problem, right? Religion has been the source of a lot of shame unnecessarily for a lot of people over the years. And so we are justifiably saying, that definition of sin that I was given is wrong. I'm checking it because it's done damage to me. And then when we do that, we also check the practice of restitutions that we were given. And maybe there's some work for excavating the difference between the disagreement about the concept of what went wrong and the practices that have been developed over hundreds and hundreds of years for addressing wrong, right? And think of those as two separate conversations. What is fault? What is sin? Is a different conversation than how do we go about addressing it when we discover it. And I'm going to zoom out a little bit from the personal. This is a very inward and personal book. But of course, you know, social justice and community and the way we are together is one of my driving passions in ministry. And lately I've been reading a book by an author and a historian named Ibram Kendi. And he first wrote a book called Stamped from the Beginning, A History of Racist Ideas in America. And then he wrote a follow-up book called How to Be an Anti-Racist. And one of the things he names in the follow-up book, where he kind of extrapolates practices from this history, is that confession, awareness of fault, has to be part of our process. We cannot move forward unless we are willing to look honestly and truthfully at where fault has occurred and name it, feel it, work with it, and then figure out how do we go from holding ourselves like this to opening our hands and being able to honestly approach and find redress for fault. So this idea of confession and fault and finding a place to hold it open rather than clenched is not just a personal practice. It can also be a collective practice. It can be a national practice. It can be a part of our civic identity as well as our personal identity, as well as our spiritual identity, if we let it. And we have kind of an allergy in our nation to admitting wrongdoing, right? We want to put it in the past. We're so forward-looking. We're so looking ahead. You know, this country is so intent on building the bigger, better, brighter future that we have sometimes this really hard time being able to look backwards and say, yes, there are some things that have happened that have been wrong. And this chapter really opened up that idea that you can be both good and have faults. Imagine that, right? That having fault does not negate your goodness. That's true individually. Every single one of us is both good and has faults. And as a nation, as a civic entity, as a community, we can be both good and honest about our faults. And in fact, in order to be good, the rule of Saint Benedict says, you have to be honest about your faults. There is no being good and being in denial at the same time. Right?
What you just said is enshrined in a wonderful song, America the Beautiful. But people don't know it. It's the second stanza. And it says, America, America, God, mend thine every flaw. Confirm thy soul in self-control, thy liberty in law.
Right. So this process, so maybe it's time to reclaim this process of being honest about our faults, not just personally, but collectively as well. That it isn't just on us as individuals to do this private practice, but to really ask that we find ways, find practices to engage this collectively. That would be one of my hopes to come out of this kind of work together. I think we're going to move on to the next piece of attention in the book. The next chapter, Summoning the Community for Counsel on Building Consensus. And I want to check on the time here just so I can get a sense of how much time we've got. Oh, there's a clock over there. Okay, 15, good. Perfect. Summoning the Community for Counsel on Building Consensus. I loved this chapter. I love the idea of counsel. Counsel meaning the counsel here, not like counseling as in one-on-one, but counsel, a collective discernment for a path forward. And I love the title, Summoning the Community. There's something in that that speaks to me of the call, not just a request, not just, if you have time, can you make it? We've got a really important meeting down at City Hall and we need some people to show up, right? That's not a summons. That's a request. It's not a requirement. You're not being given jury duty. You're not being held accountable and you're coming in for your just punishments. No, there's a summoning here, something that speaks to a call from something that is larger than yourself, to approach a place for discernment, to discover the collective wisdom that is found in that place, in that call. It's sacred work, the work of coming together in council to discern a path forward. It's a little bit of what happens here, right? In some ways, this forms its own council about what is your path forward? What is our community's path forward? How can we excavate the wisdom that is held commonly among us, bring it up to the surface, hold it up in the center together, and leave changed. Our path forward from this place will be different because we were here and a part of that conversation. So I love this idea of counsel. In the congregation I serve at the Unitarian Society, we have a lot of conversations about something we call moral owners. Right, so the governing principles of the congregation, we have these ends. We're under what's called policy-based governance. There's all kinds of different ways to govern. In the Unitarian Universalist tradition, it's a congregationalist tradition, which means that every congregation is kind of its own authority. We don't have an ecclesiastical hierarchy. We have a Unitarian Universalist Association that's a national association that helps kind of, you know, organize some curriculum and helps kind of play matchmaker when there's a congregation looking for a minister and a minister looking for a congregation. It does mostly organizational administrative stuff to support congregations, but every congregation is financially independent. Every congregation is democratically independent. They elect their own board of trustees. They vote to call a minister when a time comes for a ministerial transition. And one of the ways a Unitarian Universalist congregation can choose to organize itself is through the governance, right? How does the board make the decisions that affect the whole congregation? Who has to be consulted? When? I'm sure all of you in all of your various communities can think of those moments when you have to rewrite bylaws, right? Very exciting, spiritually growing moments when you're dealing with bylaws. Well, one of the phrases that was introduced to our board of trustees was this concept of moral ownership. And they were asked the question, who are the moral owners of the Unitarian Society of Santa Barbara? And by that, they went on to talk about this consultant we were working with when we were in a governance transition. They went on to talk about, you know, the obvious answer to that is, well, of course, the members of the congregation, right? They are the people who vote at the congregational meetings, are the people who do the work of the spiritual community. So that is one definite group. The members of your congregation, the members of your community are the moral owners. But if you stop there, you're missing some really big pieces of who you can be in the world. If you stop with just a circle drawn around the usual suspects, well, then you kind of just self-perpetuate, right? You become a club. You make the same decisions, you have the same perspectives, you tell the same stories, and people who are like you then might eventually get into the club, but the ownership stays in a very tightly controlled place. But there are other people that influence who we are in the world and that have really important things to say when you're trying to look at vision and mission for the future. And so this question of moral ownership then extends to say, okay, beyond that usual suspects, who else needs to be in the room? Who else is affected by the decisions you're about to make? What other voices do you need to hear before you make decisions about vision and mission and future-oriented action, right? And that's what council is really about. It's about who needs to be present so that all of the wisdom can emerge in that space. And there can be maybe some unexpected solutions to hard problems, things that you never would have thought of. But if you invite these other people into the room. So one example of the moral owners for the Unitarian Society is the Freedom Warming Centers and the guests who are served by the Freedom Warming Centers. So the Freedom Warming Centers and this congregation is part of the Interfaith Collaborative Trinity Episcopal. There's a lot of faith congregations countywide. It's a countywide program that open up in the wintertime to shelter people who would otherwise be exposed to the elements and the rain and the cold, right? So it's seasonal emergency overnight shelter. Your only requirement is that you have to be able to kind of hunker down and sleep through the night and not disturb your neighbors who are also trying to sleep, right? That's it. It's a behavioral agreement, and anybody who can abide by that behavioral agreement is welcome. Well, the Freedom Warming Centers, the Unitarian Society is both the fiscal agent for it, we're kind of the operational hub, and we're a site. You know, we have volunteer teams that help host the guests overnight. So what we do, the decisions we make as the Unitarian Society, affect the warming centers, how we use our space. If we decided we wanted to, I don't know, tear down the building and rebuild a new one, well, that would have a huge impact on the warming centers. And so the board came to realize that the guests of the warming centers and the way the warming centers operate in the larger community do have a claim, a moral claim, an ethical claim on the Unitarian Society. They've become part of the fabric of who we are and the work we do in the world. And so there are times when we may need to take into account them, the guests of the warming centers, the work of the warming centers, as a moral owner of a decision-making process. You know. Likewise, I've been part of another organization that really looked towards the youth as moral owners. They're the people who are going to inherit whatever problems we create, right? So they should have a claim in the problems and the solutions to those problems. And so what would it mean to look at the youth as moral owners of a group, of a society, a congregation, a community, a city like Santa Barbara? How would Santa Barbara be different if city council considered moral ownership? Right? Who has claim to be part of this conversation? Who's not in the room who we need to specifically make an effort to include so that we can find the way forward that works for everyone and not just the people who are already holding the power? Council is a transformative way of looking at the world. It really can change the way leadership operates in the world. Any other ideas about moral ownership? Does this, I mean, if you're imagining the communities that you're a part of, and you start to think beyond just the members of the community, or the board, or the ecclesiastical authorities, or the ministers, who are the moral owners that you would name? Who has a claim on the mission and vision of a community that you're a part of? How are they involved in the decision-making and the goal-setting for that community? This chapter really talks about what changes when you shift from sort of a traditional decision-making model to a council model, right? And they give that case study kind of how the vision expands and how ideas come to the table that never would have emerged if it had just been the same 10 people who always sit around the table trying to make the decisions. And it doesn't mean those 10 people aren't acting out of what they think is the best interest of that group, right? They're doing the best they can. But our vision is limited. And when we invite, I loved the way you talked about, you know, how the presence of God or the divine can come up in these conversations that you wouldn't necessarily put into a spiritual practice place, right? But there's these unexpected breakthroughs of vision that come in when we bring different people together than we might normally bring together.
Where I live, the administration is very controlling. And my biggest dream would be that they would include us who have to live with their decisions in making those decisions. You know, because they're not, most of them are not old people like we are. And so it makes a difference. And, you know, they may mean well, but that doesn't work for us at all. You know, and it actually complicates our lives, some of the decisions they make, without us. That's what a phrase I ran into a couple years ago, and it was about women's rights, actually, but it says, nothing about us without us. And I think is a really important concept.
I love that phrase, nothing about us without us. Anytime you're making a decision on behalf of someone else, you should start to put some critical thinking into what's going on, right? If there's not somebody at the table who is part of the community who's going to be directly affected by that decision, slow down. Get them at the table before moving forward.
What's the phrase again? Moral?
Moral ownership.
Moral ownership immediately has a very divisive sound to me. I mean, because you look at all the bishops and the leaders in the churches and the people who have, the churches have split over issues, whether it's of sexuality or, and the moral ownership is usually the session where the bishops or whoever is in some kind of authoritarian leadership. Right. It sounds like they have moral ownership. Right. So there could be a lot of conflict in moral ownership. Yeah.
Who has moral ownership? Right, that's a big question. When we talk about moral owners, it's not necessarily just the people claiming moral ownership, right? It's blowing the doors open and saying, yes, there's a body that may be claiming the right to make the decisions on behalf of everybody else because somehow they are more morally and ethically you know, righteous than anybody else. And so they get to hold that session real close. And I think what the rule of St. Benedict says is that when you're living in community, moral ownership lives within the big circle of community, right? So it's kind of redefining that sense. Morality in our lexicon has a very tight, it's like putting on shoes that are a half size too small. I mean, I feel that word that way about the word morality, right? That's like when you were wrong you use the wrong fork and your parents got mad at you or somebody's going to judge you. It's a very judgy term. But if we can kind of breathe a little bit with the history of the word and think instead about who has a claim on this conversation, this decision process, where's the bigger circle here than what we're thinking of? I think we can kind of flip the script on it a little bit and get it outside of those tightly controlled authoritarian impulses to a much bigger space.
Hi. I work at the hospital, and they're in the process of changing the pension plan, and they're actually giving us a choice, which is very nice of them, but I've been asking questions about what the investment options are in terms of maybe more socially responsible ones, and I just feel like there's a huge disconnect in our whole system between you know, the people who maybe are fortunate enough to own stocks in certain companies and the CEOs and, you know, the policies that they're promoting in many cases, which are so very harmful. And I feel like there needs to be, more of a connection and transparency and all of that, because I think there needs to be moral ownership of the whole, you know, way decisions are made and all that. So
yeah, it's a big problem when we equate wealth with morality, right? I mean, it's causing huge problems in our country when we equate wealth with morality, and that the measure of whether or not something is good is about how lucrative it is. If it's lucrative, it's good, right? Is kind of the bottom line mentality. And moral ownership is a way of getting outside of that equation between wealth and morality and thinking maybe there's other ways we could think about things.
So back to who are the moral owners. And it occurs to me that one group, and we're part of that group, are elders, who may not be so actively involved in the day-to-day of congregations or communities, but who have this groundedness and experience of having failed and tried again, and mm-hmm. you know, that whole background. And I think it doesn't always happen. Sometimes, you know, I've noticed that with my own elderly relatives when they were around, that we don't seek them out for the wisdom that they hold, because they're done, but their concerns live on, and I think there's just so much wisdom that can be solicited from them.
Yeah. Right, and that's about getting people into the space, right? So it's not just about turning to the youth and saying, well, what do you think we should do, and then doing that. It's about getting all of the voices in the room together and allowing for that mysterious alchemy that happens when we exchange ideas across wisdom and experience and insight, and what emerges that wouldn't have been possible if we hadn't been in the room together.
Okay, we've been talking about moral ownership being humans and mm-hmm. people.
Right.
And I'd like to shift or open the frame a bit to, you know, who or what doesn't have a voice? And I'm thinking about all of creation, mm-hmm. not just humans. Mm-hmm. So where is our moral authority, our moral responsibility to the creatures and to the environment?
Yeah.
And I think that needs to be a big part of it as
well. I mean, how radically would we live differently if we thought of the earth as one of the moral owners of our decision making, right? It would be a radical shift in the way we choose to live in the world. We'd be run out of town, right? We wouldn't make the bottom line, right? This can be a radically countercultural way to try to live. And one of the reasons it's so difficult is it takes time, right? And I think that's why it exists in this contemplative context, because there's a sense of slowing down. And it doesn't, it's not that sort of, there's some decisions that have a timeliness that there, you gotta make it, right? There's a time frame and you gotta meet the deadline, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, if your car breaks, you need to get it fixed so you can get back to work. And you can't necessarily summon a gathering, a council of mechanics to discuss the best way to fix your carburetor. Right? So there's times for decision making and knowledge and expertise to come in, diagnose a problem, and tell you what's wrong. It doesn't mean that that type of decision making is off the table. But I do think there has to be space in our world for multiple types of decision making. And we can't apply the auto mechanic type of decision making to every question. And there's these, especially when we're making shifts in community, in things that are going to affect people's lives going for seven generations going forward. We have to practice and learn other structures for decision making beyond just the ones that we perhaps are familiar with. And so that's why I really encourage you all to think about what counsel means in this day and age, and how do we make space for it? How do we slow down into discernment? I mean, the Quaker practice here is fantastic. CLUE, the Clergy and Laity United for Economic Justice, right? This is one of the practices in CLUE, is a practice of pausing. So we'll be discussing something, what should we do? Okay, let's just sit in silence for a minute or two and let things settle and see if something emerges that hasn't had space yet, right? Sometimes we can get so fast and furious with our ideas that there's no cracks in there for other things to come through, and the introverts among us are sitting there going, why is everybody talking so much? And if you breathe and back up a little bit and allow some spaciousness, then some other things kind of come in and emerge. A little room for the spirit to breathe in the space as well. And that's countercultural, because it means slowing down. It means not being as efficient as maybe you're feeling pressured to be. But you trade off that for something, I think, much more important, with a sustainability to life that we're longing for right now. I'm going to do a time check. All right, so we are now at the delicious point of the morning. Time for breathing and allowing some space and some sociability, and then we'll come back and talk some more.